Chapter 7. The first impressions of such a place as Albro, the suburb of Genoa, where I am now, as my American friends would say, located, apostrophe can hardly fail, I should imagine, to be mournful and disappointing. It requires a little time and use to overcome the feeling of depression consequent, at first, on so much ruin and neglect. Novelty, pleasant to most people, is particularly delightful, I think, to me. I am not easily dispirited, when I have the means of pursuing my own fancies and occupations, and I believe I have some natural aptitude for accommodating myself to circumstances. But, as yet, I stroll about here, in all the holes and corners of the neighborhood, in a perpetual state of forlorn surprise, and returning to my villa. The Villa Bagnarello, it sounds romantic, but Signor Bagnarello is a butcher hard by, colon, have sufficient occupation in pondering over my new experiences, and comparing them, very much to my own amusement, with my expectations, until I wander out again. The Villa Bagnarello, or the Pink Jail, a far more expressive name for the mansion, is in one of the most splendid situations imaginable. The noble Bay of Genoa, with the deep blue Mediterranean, lies stretched out near at hand. Monstrous old desolate houses and palaces are dotted all about. Lofty hills, with their tops often hidden in the clouds, and with strong forts perched high up on their craggy sides, are close upon the left, and in front, stretching from the walls of the house, down to a ruined chapel which stands upon the bold and picturesque rocks on the seashore, are green vineyards, where you may wander all day long in partial shade, through interminable vistas of grapes, trained on the rough trellis work across the narrow paths. This sequestered spot is approached by lanes so very narrow, that when we arrived at the custom house, we found the people here had taken the measure of the narrowest among them, and were waiting to apply it to the carriage, which ceremony was gravely performed in the street, while we all stood by in breathless suspense. It was found to be a very tight fit, but just a possibility, and no more, as I am reminded every day, by the sight of various large holes which it punched in the walls on either side as it came along. We are more fortunate, I am told, than an old lady, who took a house in these parts not long ago, and who stuck fast in her carriage in the lane. And as it was impossible to open one of the doors, she was obliged to submit to the indignity of being hauled through one of the little front windows, like a harlequin. When you have got through these narrow lanes, you come to an archway, imperfectly stopped up by a rusty old gate. My gate. The rusty old gate has a bell to correspond, which you ring, as long as you like, and which nobody answers, as it has no connection whatever with the house. But there is a rusty old knocker, too very loose, so that it slides round when you touch it, and if you learn the trick of it, and knock long enough, somebody comes. The brave courier comes, and gives you admittance. You walk into a seedy little garden, all wild and weedy, from which the vineyard opens. Cross it, enter a square hall like a cellar, walk up a cracked marble staircase, and pass into a most enormous room with a vaulted roof and whitewashed walls. Not unlike a great Methodist chapel. This is the sala. It has 5 windows and 5 doors, and is decorated with pictures which would gladden the heart of one of those picture cleaners in London who hang up, as a sign, a picture divided, like Death and the Lady, at the top of the old ballad, which always leaves you in a state of uncertainty, whether the ingenious professor has cleaned one half, or dirtied the other. The furniture of this sala is a sort of red brocade. All the chairs are immovable, and the sofa weighs several tons. On the same floor, and opening out of this same chamber, are dining room, drawing room, and divers bedrooms, each with a multiplicity of doors and windows. Upstairs are divers other gaunt chambers, and a kitchen, And downstairs is another kitchen, which, with all sorts of strange contrivances for burning charcoal, looks like an alchemical laboratory. There are also some half dozen small sitting rooms, where the servants in this hot July may escape from the heat of the fire, and where the brave courier plays all sorts of musical instruments of his own manufacture, all the evening long. A mighty old, wandering, ghostly, echoing, grim, bare house it is, as ever I beheld or thought of. There is a little vine-covered terrace, opening from the drawing room. And under this terrace, and forming one side of the little garden, is what used to be the stable. It is now a cow house, and has three cows in it, so that we get new milk by the bucketful. There is no pasturage near, and they never go out, but are constantly lying down, and surfeiting themselves with vine leaves. Perfect Italian cows enjoying the dolce far niente all day long. They are presided over, and slept with, by an old man named Antonio, and his son, two burnt Siena natives with naked legs and feet, who wear, each, a shirt, a pair of trousers, and a red sash, with a relic, or some sacred charm like the bonbon off a 12th cake, hanging round the neck. The old man is very anxious, to convert me to the Catholic faith, and exhorts me frequently. We sit upon a stone by the door, sometimes in the evening, like Robinson Crusoe and Friday reversed, and he generally relates, towards my conversion, an abridgment of the history of St. Peter chiefly, I believe, from the unspeakable delight he has in his imitation of the cock. The view, as I have said, is charming. But in the day you must keep the lattice blinds close shut, or the sun would drive you mad. And when the sun goes down you must shut up all the windows, or the mosquitoes would tempt you to commit suicide. So at this time of the year, you don't see much of the prospect within doors. As for the flies, you don't mind them. Nor the fleas, whose size is prodigious, and whose name is Legion, and who populate the coach house to that extent, that I daily expect to see the carriage going off bodily, drawn by myriads of industrious fleas in harness. The rats are kept away, quite comfortably, by scores of lean cats, who roam about the garden for that purpose. The lizards, of course, nobody cares for. They play in the sun, and don't bite. The little scorpions are merely curious. The beetles are rather late, and have not appeared yet. The frogs are company. There is a preserve of them in the grounds of the next villa, and after nightfall, one would think that scores upon scores of women in pattens were going up and down a wet stone pavement without a moment's cessation. That is exactly the noise they make. The ruined chapel, on the picturesque and beautiful seashore, was dedicated, once upon a time, to St. John the Baptist. I believe there is a legend that St. John's bones were received there, with various solemnities, when they were first brought to Genoa, for Genoa possesses them to this day. When there is any uncommon tempest at sea, they are brought out and exhibited to the raging weather, which they never fail to calm. In consequence of this connection of St. John with the city, great numbers of the common people are christened Giovanni Baptista, which latter name is pronounced in the Genese patois Baticcia, apostrophe like a sneeze. To hear everybody calling everybody else Baticcia, on a Sunday, or festa day, when there are crowds in the streets, is not a little singular and amusing to a stranger. The narrow lanes have great villas opening into them, whose walls, outside walls, I mean, are profusely painted with all sorts of subjects, grim and holy. But time and the sea air have nearly obliterated them, and they look like the entrance to Vauxhall Gardens on a sunny day. The courtyards of these houses are overgrown with grass and weeds. All sorts of hideous patches cover the bases of the statues, as if they were afflicted with a cutaneous disorder. The outer gates are rusty, and the iron bars outside the lower windows are all tumbling down. Firewood is kept in halls, where costly treasures might be heaped up, mountains high. Waterfalls are dry and choked. Fountains, Too dull to play, and too lazy to work, have just enough recollection of their identity, in their sleep, to make the neighborhood damp, and the Sirocco wind is often blowing over all these things for days together, like a gigantic oven out for a holiday. Not long ago, there was a festa day, in honor of the Virgin's mother, when the young men of the neighborhood, having worn green wreaths of the vine in some procession or other, bathed in them, by scores. It looked very odd and pretty, though I am bound to confess, not knowing of the festa at that time, that I thought, and was quite satisfied, they wore them as horses do to keep the flies off. Soon afterwards, there was another festa day, in honor of St. Nazaro. One of the Elbro young men brought two large bouquets soon after breakfast, and coming upstairs into the great sala, presented them himself. This was a polite way of begging for a contribution towards the expenses of some music in the saint's honor, so we gave him, whatever it may have been, and his messenger departed, well satisfied. At 6 o'clock in the evening we went to the church close at hand, a very gaudy place, hung all over with festoons and bright draperies, and filled, from the altar to the main door, with women, all seated. They wear no bonnets here, simply a long white veil, the misero, apostrophe, and it was the most gauzy, ethereal-looking audience I ever saw. The young women are not generally pretty, but they walk remarkably well, and in their personal carriage and the management of their veils, display much innate grace and elegance. There were some men present, not very many, and a few of these were kneeling about the aisles, while everybody else tumbled over them. Innumerable tapers were burning in the church. The bits of silver and tin about the saints, especially in the Virgin's necklace, sparkled brilliantly. The priests were seated about the chief altar. The organ played away, lustily, and a full band did the like, while a conductor, in the little gallery opposite to the band, hammered away on the desk before him, with a scroll, and a tenor, without any voice, sang. The band played one way, the organ played another, the singer went a third, and the unfortunate conductor banged and banged, and flourished his scroll on some principle of his own, apparently well satisfied with the whole performance. I never did hear such a discordant din. The heat was intense all the time. The men, in red caps, and with loose coats hanging on their shoulders, they never put them on, were playing bowls, and buying sweetmeats, immediately outside the church. When half a dozen of them finished a game, they came into the aisle, crossed themselves with the holy water, knelt on one knee for an instant, and walked off again, to play another game at bowls. They are remarkably expert at this diversion, and will play in the stony lanes and streets, and on the most uneven and disastrous ground for such a purpose, with as much nicety as on a billiard table. But the most favorite game is the national one of Mora, which they pursue with surprising ardor, and at which they will stake everything they possess. It is a destructive kind of gambling, requiring no accessories but the 10 fingers, which are always, I intend no pun at hand. Two men play together. One calls a number, say the extreme one, 10. He marks what portion of it he pleases by throwing out 3, or 4, or 5 fingers, and his adversary has, in the same instant, at hazard, and without seeing his hand, to throw out as many fingers as will make the exact balance. Their eyes and hands become so used to this, and act with such astonishing rapidity, that an uninitiated bystander would find it very difficult, if not impossible, to follow the progress of the game. The initiated, however, of whom there is always an eager group looking on, devour it with the most intense avidity, and as they are always ready to champion one side or the other in case of a dispute, and are frequently divided in their partisanship, it is often a very noisy proceeding. It is never the quietest game in the world, for the numbers are always called in a loud, sharp voice, and follow as close upon each other as they can be counted. on the holiday evening, standing at a window, or walking in a garden, or passing through the streets, or sauntering in any quiet place about the town, you will hear this game in progress in a score of wine shops at once, and looking over any vineyard walk, or turning almost any corner, will come upon a knot of players in full cry. It is observable that most men have a propensity to throw out some particular number oftener than another, and the vigilance with which two sharp-eyed players will mutually endeavor to detect this weakness, and adapt their game to it, is very curious and entertaining. The effect is greatly heightened by the universal suddenness and vehemence of gesture, two men playing for half a farthing with an intensity as all-absorbing, as if the stake were life. Hard by here is a large palazzo, formerly belonging to some member of the Brignole family, but just now hired by a school of Jesuits for their summer quarters. I walked into its dismantled precincts the other evening about sunset, and couldn't help pacing up and down for a little time, drowsily taking in the aspect of the place, which is repeated hereabouts in all directions. I loitered to and fro, under a colonnade, forming two sides of a weedy, grass-grown courtyard, whereof the house formed a third side, and a low terrace walk, overlooking the garden and the neighboring hills, the fourth. I don't believe there was an uncracked stone in the whole pavement. In the center was a melancholy statue, so peopled in its decay, that it looked exactly as if it had been covered with sticking plaster, and afterwards powdered. The stables, coach houses, offices, were all empty, all ruinous, all utterly deserted. Doors had lost their hinges, and were holding on by their latches. Windows were broken, painted plaster had peeled off, and was lying about in clods. Fowls and cats had so taken possession of the outbuildings that I couldn't help thinking of the fairy tales, and eyeing them with suspicion, as transformed retainers, waiting to be changed back again. One old Tom in particular, a scraggy brute, with a hungry green eye, a poor relation, in reality, I am inclined to think, Colin came prowling round and round me, as if he half believed, for the moment, that I might be the hero come to marry the lady, and set all to rights. But discovering his mistake, he suddenly gave a grim snarl, and walked away with such a tremendous tail, that he couldn't get into the little hole where he lived, but was obliged to wait outside, until his indignation and his tail had gone down together. In a sort of summer house, or whatever it may be, in this colonnade, some Englishmen had been living, like grubs in a nut. But the Jesuits had given them notice to go, and they had gone, and that was shut up to the house. A wandering, echoing, thundering barrack of a place, with the lower windows barred up, as usual, was wide open at the door. And I have no doubt I might have gone in, and gone to bed, and gone dead, and nobody a bit the wiser. Only one suite of rooms on an upper floor was tenanted. And from one of these, the voice of a young lady vocalist, practicing bravura lustily, came flaunting out upon the silent evening. I went down into the garden, intended to be prim and quaint, with avenues, and terraces, and orange trees, and statues, and water in stone basins, and everything was green, gaunt, weedy, straggling, undergrown or overgrown, mildewy, damp, redolent of all sorts of slabby, clammy, creeping, and uncomfortable life. There was nothing bright in the whole scene, but a firefly, one solitary firefly showing against the dark bushes like the last little speck of the departed glory of the house, and even it went flitting up and down at sudden angles, and leaving a place with a jerk, and describing an irregular circle, and returning to the same place with a twitch that startled one, as if it were looking for the rest of the glory, and wondering, heaven knows it might, what had become of it. In the course of 2 months, the flitting shapes and shadows of my dismal entering reverie gradually resolved themselves into familiar forms and substances, and I already began to think that, when the time should come, a year hence, for closing the long holiday and turning back to England, I might part from Genoa with anything but a glad heart. It is a place that grows upon you every day. There seems to be always something to find out in it. There are the most extraordinary alleys, and byways to walk about in. You can lose your way.
What a comfort that is, when you are idle.
20 times a day, if you like, and turn up again, under the most unexpected and surprising difficulties. It abounds in the strangest contrasts. Things that are picturesque, ugly, mean, magnificent, delightful, and offensive, break upon the view at every turn. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.